This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Out with the old, in with the new, or is it? You know, Tim, 2023, we're off and running. And yet this week, many of the main themes of 2022 are already a big part of the New Year's narrative.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking inflation and hawkish monetary policy, remaining global trends. And in the U.S. specifically, a continued focus on the tight labor market and a central bank that's hell-bent on continuing to raise interest rates to bring down inflation. The Fed's latest minutes from this past week served as a warning not to anticipate any sort of pivot, at least, Carol, in the near term.
With that in mind, coming up this hour, we learn about one of the Fed's newer members who's using her diverse background and education to help guide her policy decisions. We'll profile Boston Fed Chief Susan Collins.
We'll also look at how badly big tech's nosedive is impacting some of the world's richest people and why it may actually be okay to enjoy it a little. Schadenfreude, anyone? Plus, we'll get a postscript from Business Week's recent cover-to-cover issue about the crypto story, which came out just days ahead of FTX's collapse. A bit of hindsight never hurt anyone.
Well, it was like a great primer, right? To set us up for the collapse in many ways. All right, all of that to come. We begin with U.S. politics. Interesting last year, already proving to be fascinating this year. Of course, the big story this week, the drama surrounding the election of a new Speaker of the House. Meantime, though, Business Week is focusing on another election.
This week's cover story centers on a man who looks poised to run for the highest office in the land come 2024. We're talking about Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. He's increasingly found himself in the spotlight in recent months, thanks in part to a tax on business leaders who promote progressive values.
And his rhetoric is finding traction within Republican grassroots circles. To better understand the DeSantis strategy and how he is crafting his own version of the Donald Trump playbook, we turn now to Bloomberg Businessweek national correspondent Josh Green and the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, Joel Weber.
Yeah, obviously there's been a mess in D.C. this week. But I think almost the bigger political story that is going to perhaps have a longer trajectory is the Ron DeSantis narrative. And we've been obsessed with this one for a while, especially coming out of midterms, because what midterms really showed was how much of Florida has been galvanized behind Ron DeSantis. And now the question becomes, can Ron DeSantis actually take that narrative and make it be a national one? And to do that, Josh pointed out something that I thought was just incredible, which is, unlike many Republican predecessors, DeSantis has managed to put a target on business in a way that no one else has ever done before. And that has really galvanized grassroots support behind DeSantis. So Josh, turn it over to you. What did you learn about Ron DeSantis as you were working on this story?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing to me when I set out to do this story in the fall was that here was a guy who's clearly talented, clearly wants to run for president in 2024, and yet faces the same big impediment that every other Republican who wants to run for president does. And that's Donald Trump, who's like the 800-pound gorilla and has managed to kind of sideline all comers. What's so interesting about DeSantis and what sets him apart from other Republicans like Mike Pence or Mike Pompeo, secondary Trump figures who are known to kind of want to run for president, is that he's cracked the code of how do you build a profile for yourself among grassroots Republicans that isn't contingent on your standing with Donald Trump. And the way that DeSantis has managed to do that is by starting the big culture war grievances that Republicans love, that the Fox News audiences love. Only unlike Trump, which makes everything about him, DeSantis has made it about business and corporate America and companies like Disney and their alleged wokeism. And that's really struck a chord with a lot of grassroots conservative followers who are now lining up behind DeSantis, and it turned him into a viable threat, I think, to win the nomination in 2024.
How is it that business, friend, former friend of the GOP, all of a sudden has been a great enemy that DeSantis has been able to leverage?
It's a great question. It sort of happened gradually. Business has always been the great ally of the traditional Republican establishment. They've been simpatico on policy. They've helped fund a lot of these guys. But DeSantis is an interesting case in that he's always been a bit of an outsider. When he first ran for governor in 2018, he was like languishing in third place and was not the choice of the business community. In fact, the big businesses in Florida, like sugar and construction, attacked DeSantis because they had another candidate in mind. But DeSantis very cleverly warmed up to Donald Trump, got Trump's endorsement, and that vaulted him into the governor's mansion. And I think DeSantis feels like, A, he really doesn't owe anything to big business. You know, he hasn't had any problems raising money. But B, more and more people, I think, in our culture view big business as an enemy or a player in the culture wars in a way that maybe they didn't a generation ago. So you've got the George Floyd protests. You have Colin Kaepernick protests on police violence with Nike. Corporate America has become politicized, and what DeSantis has done is really leverage that for his own political needs.
But just slow that down for a second. I mean, you cannot imagine a bigger industry in Florida than sugar. And the first thing that Ron DeSantis does is take on big sugar. What did he learn from that? And what did others learn about him in the process?
Well, what's interesting about the historical context, I mean, sugar is one of the big industries there, has a ton of money, is very actively involved in politics. And in 2018, they were supporting the state agriculture commissioner, who was their guy. And they ran a lot of negative ads on DeSantis. If you step back, though, and think about what sugar needs in the context of modern Republican politics, they need cheap immigrant labor, you know, and they want open markets. Well, what's been the big change in Republican politics since Donald Trump came in? He's turned the party very anti-immigrant and very anti-trade. And so that helped drive a wedge, I think, between traditional Republicans and kind of Trump DeSantis style Republicans. So it's much easier for DeSantis to go out and attack sugar, not based on kind of state economic grounds, but more on culture and on issues of should they be able to use immigrant labor. Well, you have this kind of populist uprising that certainly saw in 2016 around Donald Trump and a lot of other candidates that now at least Florida has gravitated very strongly to Ron DeSantis. And it's worth pointing out, this isn't just Republicans and Trump supporters. He also won a lot of independents and a lot of Democratic voters, too. So he's really come up with a formula that has worked well in Florida and could conceivably work on the national level, too.
But can he take on Donald Trump? Can he go head to head with Donald Trump? As we've learned in the midterms, DeSantis was very popular, Trump not so much. But as you write, people have made the mistake of counting out Trump before.
Yeah, and DeSantis' strategy, you know, when I was down there, Trump was still considered this big, imposing figure. And DeSantis' strategy has been to ignore him entirely, to put off that fight. Even in the weeks since I was down in Florida, there's been kind of a vibe shift in Republican politics where suddenly, you know, Donald Trump doesn't seem quite as big and scary as he once did. I mean, part of that is that Republicans fared so poorly, especially Trump's candidates in the midterm elections. But he just seems to be a shrunken figure compared to what he was 6 months or a year ago. So at least for the time being, you know, DeSantis is the hot brand among Republican donors and a lot of Republican voters. But as you said, at some point, if he wants the Republican nomination, he's going to have to get up on a debate stage and challenge Donald Trump. And so far, nobody has done that and survived. So maybe he'll be the first.
So he's taken on this corporate wokeness. Where does he go from here as a candidate if he's going to actually go to this national stage?
Well, it's working for him. I mean, he started out with Disney and criticizing a lot of the companies that were openly supporting Black Lives Matter after George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis. What's happened since then is that I think he's recognized, this really resonates, and he's broadened out the fight on corporate wokeness to focus on big Wall Street banks and big asset managers, companies like BlackRock, people like BlackRock's CEO Larry Fink. He's kind of turned them into the new villains for Republicans because, you know, there's never going to be a lot of grassroots support for Wall Street firms. But he's claiming that they are woke, that they're diverting traditional capitalist goals of building shareholder value in order to pursue liberal social justice goals like curbing global warming and so on. There's a degree of truth in what he's in what he's saying, but everything I've seen is that this really does resonate with Republican voters. If you watch Fox News primetime, maybe not this week with the chaos we have going on down here in Washington,
right.
But any other week. And this is something that Republicans care about. It looks like it's resonating, and that's all good for Ron DeSantis' political future.
Josh, I'm stealing your words here, but you know, you kind of ask in your story, you know, can though DeSantis replace Trump's rages? For example, you write, you know, can DeSantis' attacks on ESG and Larry Fink eclipse Trump's crusade of crooked Hillary and Lion Ted in the pantheon of MAGA villains? It's a great question. Like, can it, and can it resonate nationally?
Yeah, and I don't think we have an answer to that yet. I mean, I'll be honest, like, I was a little skeptical going into this piece, but I went down, I traveled around Florida, talked to a lot of politicians, including Democrats, talked to some Fox News producers, people like that, and it really does register. And it's not just Ron DeSantis saying this. I mean, you have other candidates like Mike Pence who are now trying to hop on the wokeness bandwagon. It's just something that seems to resonate with Republicans. So at least so far, it's working for DeSantis. But again, at some point, you're going to have to confront Donald Trump. And that's a showdown we haven't seen yet.
That was Bloomberg Businessweek national correspondent Josh Green, along with editor Joel Weber, on this week's cover story. Joel's sticking around for our next segment.
Coming up, lessons that Boston Fed President Susan Collins took from the likes of MIT, Michigan, and Jamaica on her way to becoming the first Black woman to head a regional Fed bank.
She was in this circle, monetary policymakers, but this is her first time in a role where she's actually helping to decide that policy.
You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
As we mentioned earlier, the 2023 narrative already full of Fed talk. This week, we got the minutes from the last FOMC meeting of 2022. Fed officials affirming their resolve to bring down inflation and really pushing back against investors who are banking on rate cuts sooner rather than later.
With that in mind, we flipped to the economics section of this week's edition of Bloomberg Business Week to profile an FOMC trailblazer. With more on why Boston Fed Chief Susan Collins brings a distinct voice to the table, we turn to Janelle Marte, economics and Federal Reserve reporter at Bloomberg News, as well as the editor of the magazine, Joel Weber.
Part of why I think this is a significant story to start talking about at the beginning of this year is actually this is the most diverse the Fed has really ever looked, and there's still room for improvement. But Susan Collins, first Black woman to head a regional Fed bank out of Boston. What makes her incredible is sort of this backstory that you briefly mentioned there. And what I find just so compelling about this is we get to now see the Fed grappling with, for the last year and change, it's been this unprecedented moment with inflation. But we also get to do it on the heels and ongoing awareness of how much inequality there is of both racial and economic in the country. And so in many ways, this is like the perfect challenge for somebody like Susan Collins. So Janelle, talk to us more about her backstory and what she brings to the Fed, which it's worth also mentioning here that she is not a voting member on rates for this year, but she is part of the discussion.
Yes. So Susan Collins came to the Fed. Her background was largely in academics before. She was at the University of Michigan, where she was most recently the provost, but was also a dean there of the Ford Public School. And she was not a stranger to the Fed because of her role at the university, but also she was already a regular at the very famous Jackson Hole symposium that happens every year. So she was in this circle of monetary policymakers. But this is her first time in a role where she's actually helping to decide that policy. And last year, she jumped right in, 3 weeks into the job, had to start voting, and has been pretty vocal in the last several months. And I would say that one of the things I've noticed after spending some time with her and talking to her a little bit is that some of the themes that she encountered as a child, spending her summers with family in Jamaica, things that she still reflects on now, and with the lens of her expertise that she developed, having a PhD in economics from MIT and, you know, the research that she's done, is she started to see these issues early on, right? So inequality in Jamaica, noticing the difference in living standards and comparing that to what she saw here in the U.S. growing up in Manhattan. She talked to me about reflecting on how communities really struggle there when the country introduced its own currency, and grappling with that as a child, and then, you know, how that came into play later on when she became an economist.
So what do you think, I know it's hard to speculate on this because so many of the Fed discussions happen behind closed doors and we get very few, very few moments of smoke drifting out in moments of like dot plots and stuff. But what do you think the conversation with her is like, and what would it, you know, what does she bring to that table with her experience, and you know, what do we know about the dynamic that she brings to the Fed as they continue these discussions about where rates and other things might go?
So one thing that she's talked about when meeting with community groups here in the U.S. around her district is that she really believes that the Fed's mission is to create an economy that doesn't just work for some people, but that it works for all. So I feel like that's one of her big messages in the role, is that she thinks that the Fed has a priority to really have an inclusive mission here. And that's gonna be important as we move forward this year. You've already talked about the rate increases. And the next phase for the Fed is really to figure out, all right, well, where are we, how is this showing up in the labor market? And when is it time to stop? You know, when will it be time to cut back on the rate, cut back on rates, essentially? And so I think this, like, this focus that she has on inclusivity, on having an economy that works for everyone, could play a bigger part as the Fed really shifts its focus to the labor market.
But as you write, the problem that we could be facing as a country, if we do see weakness that is brought on by the Fed, as you write, Janelle, is that marginalized workers, including Black and Hispanic people, often are the last to benefit from an economic expansion. They could then face the brunt of economic pain if we do see any sort of weakness or a recession. How is she thinking about that?
That's something that she mentioned to us. We had a meeting, she met with some reporters in Boston not too long ago. And she said that she takes that very seriously, that she recognizes that it could be marginalized workers that carry the worst of the pain there. And so I think that'll be on her mind. She's still, of course, very focused on bringing inflation down, and has supported the rate increases that the Fed has done so far. All of the votes have been unanimous. So the Fed is very unified.
Right.
I think it'll be interesting to see where she stands if we start to see more division.
Janelle, what I think is interesting, and you highlight it in your piece, you talk about how she has this wonderful knack of combining math with her interest in social issues. So I feel like a little bit of left-right brain stuff going on. But for for Fed, that constantly reminds us that they are data dependent. She's going to pull in the data to say, this is why we have to have a recovery where everyone participates. And I wonder how that's going to play out among the Fed members.
Yes. I mean, that was something that came across with me speaking with some of her former colleagues and former professors, that they all had that comment that she was really, she relies on the evidence. She's evidence driven, was always that way from her undergraduate days. And so also she seeks input, and she likes to match the data to stories. And you can already see that in the way that she prioritized traveling around the district, meeting with different stakeholders, the workers, the community groups that are affected by the Fed's rate increases. So I think she'll be combining what she hears from people on the ground with what she sees in the data, and that will definitely influence her decision making.
So what do we think, this, just bringing it back to the Fed, this being the most diverse Fed we've seen, there's still not a Hispanic member in that group of people behind closed doors. How much tension is there on Jay Powell and others to make sure that they become even more inclusive? And what do we expect on that front this year?
And just got about 30 seconds.
So there's certainly a lot of pressure on the Fed to continue to increase its diversity. We have one more open slot coming with the Kansas City Fed president that has to be announced after Esther George retires. So, you know, there's an opportunity there for them to do something. We'll see how it all plays out.
More diversity has to change the way the conversation moves, right? At the Fed, no doubt about it, Joel.
Yeah, I just think it was something that we were not aware of. And then we showed how important it was to be more aware. And it actually just might make the economy stronger even.
That was Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber, along with Janelle Marte. She's economics and Federal Reserve reporter here at Bloomberg News. A reminder that who Fed members are is just as important as what they do.
Still ahead on Bloomberg Businessweek, it's been a tough year for a lot of people. We know that even some of the richest and most influential people on the planet.
Silicon Valley and the crypto world has been sort of living in this kind of weird, bubbly situation for a long time, having to do with interest rates and also COVID, where you had people stuck at home, spending more and more time online, and that created this self-reinforcing bubble where it sort of looked like tech was going to go up forever. And this year, we had four billionaires lose a huge sum of money. Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Changpeng Zhao, the CEO of Binance, and of course, Musk, who was the biggest loser of them all.
Why now is the time to relish in the struggles of the financial elite? This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
This week's remarks in Bloomberg Businessweek magazine is written by Bloomberg Businessweek columnist Max Chafkin. They are about the great comeuppance for some of the world's billionaires and how there has never been a better time for billionaire schadenfreude. This was something that we knew we wanted to hear more about from Max directly.
And we got Max with us right now. Max, you write about wealthy elites from Elon Musk to Mark Zuckerberg and Peter Thiel and even former President Donald Trump. There are also some crypto billionaires, or perhaps formerly billionaires in there. These are people who are used to having their own way, and 2022 proved to be a reckoning of sorts. So I want to start there and just really set the backdrop for your piece and how you're thinking about this great comeuppance.
Right. This idea was actually sort of a brainstorm session I had with another editor, Pat Rainier, who writes about finance. And he and I were talking about just how this year, it almost felt like a lot of the insanity of the world went back to normal. And you know, there has been this time for several years, and I think obviously a lot of it was tied to COVID. Some of it had to do with financial policy, where you just had this, you know, kind of insane speculation, particularly insane speculation on tech, where for a really brief period of time, there were just these certain billionaires, I think Elon Musk being the biggest example, who were just defying gravity. And we just saw like almost this unreality that existed for a few years. And that unreality, you know, that the spell, it feels like is broken. You know, one thing that's interesting is interest rates right now are not that high historically. And yet, you know, in Silicon Valley, it's being experienced that way. And yeah. I think part of that has to do with the fact that Silicon Valley and the crypto world, as you say, Tim, has been sort of living in this kind of weird, bubbly situation for a long time, having to do with interest rates and also COVID, where you had people stuck at home, spending more and more time online. And that created this self-reinforcing bubble where it sort of looked like tech was going to go up forever. One other thing I'll just say in context, Masayoshi Son, the chairman of SoftBank Corp, he had what is like widely regarded as the biggest record for like a net worth loss during the dot-com crash. He lost $70 billion, or sometimes it's $80 billion. He lost a huge sum of money within, you know, the span of less than a year. And this year we had four billionaires lose more than that. Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Changpeng Zhao, the CEO of Binance, and of course Musk, who was the biggest loser of them all.
You know, you talk about Elon Musk a lot in this story, and it's funny, you were talking about Silicon Valley and kind of living in this bubble of low rates and so on and so forth. I also feel like, and let's mention another billionaire who lost a lot, Mark Zuckerberg. He's been living in his new version of the world, and that's called the metaverse.
Well, I think that Zuckerberg, it's so funny, we've talked about this before, but you know, Musk's sort of self-inflicted hubristic performance in 2022 has really overshadowed the self-inflicted hubristic performance of Mark Zuckerberg, who of course has this amazingly successful business, and for reasons that I think kind of befuddle many of his investors, many of his employees, has sort of turned away from that towards the metaverse. And I think where as you said, there's been very little success. I mean, you know, just very few users. Futurists, of course, are excited, but the proof is not there yet. And I think what happened actually in both the case of Zuckerberg and Musk, and probably Bezos too, is you had conditions where really it seemed like they could go no wrong. Where mm-hmm. where in the case of Musk, borrowing billions of dollars to buy this kind of dopey social media company for laughs, Twitter, that somehow made financial sense. And with Zuckerberg, kind of the same thing, where he's sort of running into this bit of a growth problem. Of course, that's hard for a big public company, but decides to answer it with again this, you know, this technology that really nobody seems to want. And Bezos, you look at Amazon just announced that its layoffs are going to be even bigger than people expected. Amazon for years has been expanding into all of these businesses that are, you know, some of them have made sense, some of them haven't really panned out. Whole Foods, retail, you know, smart speakers, even the successes there, I don't know how successful they've been from a business standpoint. So I think it's a case of where you had a lot of these guys where there's just almost an unlimited amount of money, and that allowed them to kind of grow and expand or pursue things that I think in retrospect look pretty inadvisable.
What about the existential question here? The idea of a shot in
Don't front. Go there, Tim. Don't.
Well,
don't.
I just wonder why, you know, why do people sort of look on with glee when they see these fortunes burning up?
Well, I think a part of it, as I said, is a sense of kind of an unreality, right? I mean, you had people for years, in the case of Tesla, kind of like normal car industry people, the Tesla skeptics. Nobody was really listening to them because their mm-hmm. story was pretty boring. And on the other side, you had the bulls. And the bull case, you know, Cathie Wood, who's sort of talking about, you know, fleets of robo-taxis. And, you know, that is just like a lot more exciting and it's a lot more sexy. And I think...
And some of it bears out.
Of course.
Look at Tesla. Yeah. I mean, it became a big company selling a lot of stuff.
It has. Although many of those crazy things that I think were propelling the valuation, you know, have yet to bear fruit.
Fair.
And so I think to the extent that it's satisfying, I think that's part of it. It's like a recognition that, yeah, the laws do apply. And I think during Musk's Twitter drama or whatever, watching the Delaware courts, you know, basically say, hey, you know, the rule of law applies to you, sir. Like that is, I think there's a sense of justice in that. But one thing I'll say is, if you're feeling satisfied, you know, you got to watch out because, right, the schadenfreude that, you know, is applying to Elon Musk, like it could come for us all.
Would you say at the end of your story, like, hey, everybody, you know, he's still worth what, $130 billion and stuff could still bear out?
Well, absolutely. And of course, a recession hasn't come yet. Elon Musk is kind of suffering in public in this kind of really epic, you know, maybe melodramatic way. But of course, you know, many of the same dynamics, I think, that apply to Tesla apply to many of us, although in smaller, you know, smaller scale. A lot of people overinvested in real estate. A lot of people, you know, did dumb things on the stock market. So,
right.
So you know, there's potential for this to kind of grow.
Yeah. I mean, find me someone whose 401k isn't down 20%. So, you know, at least last year.
Can't
so
look, it hurts.
At least
it burns
it
my eyes.
But at
you
least
know those
it
Twitter
wasn't
eyes? That's what happens when I look
at my 401k.
At least
it wasn't $133 billion.
The other thing, though, I love is you also get into politics, which didn't play out exactly as we thought as well. And politics happened to be the cover story, too, of this week's issue.
Well, yeah. And I think that this stuff was connected because, of course, the money that has sort of floated these like epic billionaires, you know, Elon Musk, people who are richer than anyone has ever been in history, was kind of coming towards politics. And I think in the sort of most obvious way that this happened is with Sam Bankman-Fried, mm-hmm. who kind of, you know, almost overnight became this serious political player. Now, of course, he had an agenda. He was trying to get, you know, the U.S. government to essentially legalize parts of his business that were not yet legal, that he was operating offshore. But he was was making serious donations to Democrats from himself. A deputy also working for him was making almost as big donations to Republicans. These were some of the biggest donors during the 2022 cycle. Mm-hmm. And he had sort of signaled earlier this year when he was still riding high, he said, I'm going to donate $1 billion to candidates during 2024, which would be, you know, unprecedented. And so that, I think, is that's going to throw all this in chaos. There are a lot of people in Congress who were taking money from Sam Bankman-Fried or Sam Bankman-Fried's affiliates on both sides. And I don't think we quite yet know where that's all going to shake out. Also, on the Democratic establishment in particular, you know, some of these interest groups that were getting money from him, you know, you got to think that this there's going to be some fallout here. And one last thing I'll say is, you know, Donald Trump, where another case of a billionaire, obviously this is a little bit different, who kind of benefited from a sense of unreality. And with the 2022 midterm, where you sort of saw kind of the limits maybe of Trump's, you know, trolling social media persona, very similar to the way that Musk's, you know, trolling social media persona has you know, kind of shown its limits. And now we're seeing the rise of this new figure, you know, Ron DeSantis. And you know, maybe this is the end of Trumpism. But I think it's too early to write that off. But I think, you know, it's worth kind of looking at.
You know, you make up a good point. And I feel like when you talk about all of these individuals, there's something about they're kind of all living in their own worlds and not necessarily like their own reality. There's a real big part of this. And you do wonder, well, maybe some of that reality will play out, but maybe a lot won't. And it feels that way right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, this some of this has, I think, is pandemic era hangover, and some of it is we just didn't realize how much of the economic growth was built on really unstable foundations, where, you know, these kind of like minor interest rate increases throws the whole Silicon Valley machine into, you know, hopefully just temporary chaos.
All right, we've had the Great Recession, the Great Resignation. Now we have the Great Comeuppance. I'm going to use this on air a lot. Sorry,
okay, that's
we're going to borrow it. We'll send you some licensing rights or something. All right, Bloomberg Business Week columnist Max Chafkin. That's the remarks this week. Max, thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Up next, Bloomberg Opinion's Matt Levine delivers a postscript on his acclaimed one-man issue of the magazine.
A fresh chapter for the crypto story in the wake of FTX's collapse and Sam Bankman-Fried's arrest.
This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
This week in downtown New York City, FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried pleaded not guilty to criminal charges. He is set to face a trial in October. That trial expected to be one of the highest profile white collar fraud trials in recent years.
The collapse of the FTX empire happened 2 weeks after Bloomberg Business Week did a full magazine takeover in October, something that the editors had only ever done once in its history. It was the crypto story, and the whole thing was written by Bloomberg Opinion columnist Matt Levine.
Well, Matt is out with a postscript. Here's a little bit of his take on what he calls the crypto winter that got colder and darker.
Crypto really built a financial system in pretty short order that really modeled the sort of traditional financial system that kind of broke in 2008. And there's a reason for that, which is that, you know, a lot of these people came into crypto from traditional finance and they wanted to kind of like play in a less regulated, more open sandbox of crypto. And they wanted to do some of the stuff that they did in traditional finance, whether that's, you know, algorithmic trading or like, you know, borrowing or futures trading or getting a lot of leverage against their crypto trading, just as they would have done at their old trading firms. And the problem is that in stock trading and bond trading and mortgage trading, there are like kind of well understood, long established cash flows to the stuff that you are trading. And in crypto, a lot of the time, you're trading stuff that, you know, someone made up a year ago. And I think that like one way to look at not just FTX, but kind of everything that imploded over the summer is that people in crypto were doing the lending activity that they would have done in traditional finance, but against tokens that could lose their value in an instant. And in fact, at FTX, I mean, one way to look at FTX is that they ended up lending a lot of customers real money, their bitcoins, but also just their dollars. And they ended up taking that customer money and lending it to their affiliated hedge fund, Alameda, against collateral that was just kind of magic bean tokens that FTX itself had made up and that were worth a lot of money on paper when FTX was flying high, but that ended up being worth kind of nothing and not being able to pay back their customers.
So Matt, having written what you did for the magazine and then seeing kind of what happened late last year with SBF and FTX, I mean, are you increasingly thinking about crypto as, I mean, as you write in your follow-up, you know, this isn't real stuff, right? I can't at the moment really take it out and buy a lot of stuff and transact like I do, like dollars or yen.
Well, you can. I mean, you can sort of do transactional stuff in crypto. And I think that like the transactional case for crypto is relatively good, you know, not great, but relatively good. People do sometimes, not so much, you know, in the US, but in places in the world, people do, you know, sometimes buy a little stuff with Bitcoin. They do use it to transfer money. But the really grandiose claims that people made for crypto a year ago, even 6 months ago, were about building some sort of new technology infrastructure, some sort of world computer, some sort of new way to do tech investing, some sort of new way to build real stuff in the real world. In some ways, crypto was not primarily, I mean, Bitcoin was originally sort of designed as this like payments mechanism, mm-hmm. but I think in like the real heyday of crypto enthusiasm, it was viewed not just as a way to do payments, but as a way to kind of like to structure businesses and invest in technology and build technology. And that story had an appeal,
right?
Even away from, you know, whether you thought the technology, the sort of story of tech investing was good. Like, even if you didn't think that crypto was going to build a new social network or a metaverse, you could say, well, if the financial system that it builds is good, maybe one day we'll trade stocks on the blockchain and that'll be good. And I think that like the real breakdown in the crypto financial system this summer, but then particularly, you know, with FTX, just undermines that case a lot. It no longer feels like all that exciting a financial system because it keeps, you know, losing people's money.
That's Matt Levine, columnist for Bloomberg Opinion. You can check out more of Matt's work online at Bloomberg.com and on the terminal by simply typing OPIN Go. And that wraps up our first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Ahead in our next hour, as the aforementioned Sam Bankman-Fried awaits his trial following his not guilty plea, a new Netflix documentary conjures up memories of the man behind the most financially devastating Ponzi scheme ever, Bernie Madoff.
Not apples to apples, but it definitely took me back, that's for sure. Plus, Yale professor Jeffrey Sonnenfeld on how his highly respected economic research turned him into an enemy of the Russian state.
Well, that's all ahead. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. It's an hour of fascinating people and places, including a fresh look at the man who is the subject of a new documentary called The Monster of Wall Street, the late Bernie Madoff.
We'll talk to nationally syndicated radio show host Jim Campbell. He's the author of Madoff Talks, uncovering the untold story behind the most notorious Ponzi scheme in history. And Jim is part of that miniseries, which debuted Wednesday on Netflix.
Tim will also welcome sommelier, restaurateur, and philanthropist Yannick Benjamin. His story of overcoming severe injury by harnessing his love of great wines and using his influence to benefit others, that story's coming up.
Yeah, we also got some pretty good wine.
We did.
Right around here, so that was nice.
He came with gifts.
Plus, our Bloomberg Pursuits team breaks down the 21 best places to travel in 2023. We're expecting to see some major tourism records broken this year. Find out why this is the time to go big with your plans. First up this hour, the individual who found himself on the wrong side of Russia, and for good reason.
You might remember last month that we talked about that viral list that turned a Yale professor into an enemy of the Russian state. It is true. We're talking about Jeffrey Sonnenfeld, who has assigned grades to 1,400 companies and in the process highlighted the economic cost of sanctions. That caught the attention
attention of Russian officials put him on the Russian stop list, which there's a few other familiar names on that list.
Yeah, one might say he's in good company. First Lady Jill Biden is on there. Senator Mitch McConnell, they're both on the list as well. We've got Jess Sonnenfeld with us right now, Senior Associate Dean for Leadership Studies, Lester Crown Professor of Leadership Practice at the Yale School of Management. Good to have you with us, Professor. Good to have you back with us, I should say. Happy New Year. And, you know, I'm eager to hear your thoughts on this. Ever since Business Week wrote this story in the magazine, I've been curious what you think now of seeing your name on that list.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back with you, Tim and Carol. Thank you so much for the invitation and Happy New Year to you as well. It's interesting. I've gotten a huge amount of feedback because everybody reads Bloomberg Business Week and follows Bloomberg. There's hardly a CEO I know that hasn't either sent a note or a call or a text message or something that sees it as a tremendous badge of honor. And that is all of them that are on the A, B, and C list. The D's and the F's, actually, I've heard from a number that are on the D list. The D list are people that they didn't pull out of Russia, but they have curtailed some future investing. The reason we came out, by the way, with the A, B, C, D, and F isn't just because we're a schoolhouse and that's all we know how to do, is that there were some very artful public relations smokescreens, some spin that was leading to a lot of atmospherics about people who were saying nice things and not doing anything. And we thought we should divide out those who actually physically pulled out permanently, who did so temporarily, who partially pulled out, who did some atmospherics, and then some who aren't doing a darn thing. And that's how we divided them out into A through F.
You are someone that is a go-to voice when it comes to leadership and understanding what goes on in C-suites. You talk with a lot of leaders. They reach out to you as well, Jeff. But I do wonder, was there something different about the Russian invasion in Ukraine that made it easier for companies to come out and say, we got to pull out of this?
Very good question, Carol, because of course CEOs are under a lot of pressure these days and getting involved and using their voice in social issues. If we were having this discussion 2 years ago, there's a stampede of enthusiasm for getting involved in voting rights or the presidential succession issues. And they've gotten some blowbacks in some states on positions on whether or not it's on environmental issues or reproductive rights for women. And CEOs have still been using their voice on these various issues. However, on this one, there is no controversy, none whatsoever. In fact, I just addressed the attorneys general of all 50 states with their deputies and lieutenants there. And there was rousing support for this move, state by state. And you can actually see that doing well is not antithetical to doing good. There's no dispute between shareholders and other stakeholders. The more dramatically the companies pulled out, and our research shows this, the better they were rewarded in their financial performance.
How is this different? Help me out here, though. When I think about what happened to Jamal Khashoggi in, you know, the journalist, right, that was killed, assassinated. How is this different from the mass killings in Syria? How is it different that companies can come out and speak out against what happened in terms of this Russian war in Ukraine versus those? What's different?
Those are, you know, a great example of I was worried after the killing of Khashoggi, Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post columnist that was, I think, a U.S. resident at that point, working on citizenship,
right.
That there was condemnation and there was a slight delay. And ultimately, there was a mass exodus from that Davos in the desert. But, Carol, you would say a year later, they went back. And some of our top officials still went over to some companies. There is mass suffering around the world. We can take a look at an awful lot of hotspots where there's a tremendous amount of injustice. And the question is, it's like a hospital ER right now. We have here at Yale New Haven Hospital, like around the country, we have a rising tide of respiratory viruses. We have the flu. We of course, have this new strain of COVID. And we have car accidents. The weather here is horrible today. So there are a lot of car accidents. And after a while, you know, an ER is going to say, enough, we don't want any more. No, they don't do that. They just decide on a triage basis what some things are worse than other things. The mass slaughter of moms with their babies in their arms lined up for bread, that's different. Bombing orphanages, bombing hospitals, targeting civilians for this mass carnage, those kind of level of atrocities are worse than some horrible other types of injustices. But you're right. We need to take moral positions when we can. In this case, the operational risk, the financial risk, the reputation risk of staying in Russia was so high that the companies who have stayed have suffered. And we also have very little interest in being involved there. Some bring up China, for example, and that's way more complicated because of the intertwined economics. Right now, Russia brings, I mean, the moral decision is easy because the pragmatics are so easy. Russia brings nothing to the global marketplace other than food and fuel.
So Jeff, is it then a financial decision? It's an easy financial decision when it comes to Russia, but maybe not so much when it's Saudi Arabia or China, for instance.
It's easier when we take a look at Saudi Arabia. What we did see, it's targeted. Some kicking and screaming and some enthusiastically, but every major fashion house pulled out of the Xinjiang province over that really fine cotton, of course, that's made there with the alleged detainment of, you know, these awful conditions of the forced labor of the Uyghur minority population. That's pretty horrible. And we've seen every fashion house pull out of there. And that's really fantastic cotton. And that's made a big difference. And so we see that there are targeted, you know, people ask, what about there's an invasion of Taiwan? What about? There isn't one yet. If there is, we'll see. But right now, we've seen there is an invasion of a sovereign nation, a democratic sovereign nation, and a mass slaughter with mass atrocities, that this isn't a category by itself in the world right now. But there may be other situations that come to the fore where we need to get involved as well. But right now, this is the one. If it doesn't look like we have fortitude here, there certainly will be others. It's important to show that the world, united as they are, only 40% of these companies that pulled out, these 1,300 companies that pulled out, are American. They're from every part of the world that pulled out, which is fantastic.
Professor, what have you heard from the companies that haven't yet pulled out yet? And I'm just going through, there are several versions of this list that you can look at on Yale's website, and then another one, YaleRussianBusinessRetreat.com as well, for a sortable version of that list if our listeners and viewers want to check that out. But some are, you know, business as usual, still operating in Russia, still selling products to Russia. What have you heard from these companies?
Well, it's surprising. You know, I've been tracking for 45 years now, looking at corporate social impact issues with the Business Roundtable, with the founding generation of the Business Roundtable. I'm that old. And the first movers in this case aren't the usual ones. The ones who pulled out early were big oil, big tech, and professional service firms. For various reasons, you can imagine that those three clusters are not usually on the front lines of social justice issues. They were in this case. Those who are staying are a weird mix across industries. Places like International Paper, what are they doing there?
You got Match Group here. You give them an F grade.
Match.com. What in the world are they trying to bring social harmony in to the Soviet Union and to Russia right now? I mean, there's some twisted belief that some had that these global brands, if you remember Tom Friedman in the New York Times, I hope he's not your best friend, but one of his most naive columns was a column that was very widely circulated a few years ago on the Golden Arches rule of diplomacy, that any two countries with a McDonald's would never go to war with each other.
Yeah.
And this led some U.S. brands to think that this is a way of a refutation of old Soviet repression by celebrating U.S. That's crazy.
That was Jeffrey Sonnenfeld. He's Senior Associate Dean for Leadership Studies and Lester Crown Professor of Leadership Practice at the Yale School of Management. And of course, Mr. Sonnenfeld's comments and opinions are his own and do not reflect those of Bloomberg Media nor our parent company, Bloomberg LP.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, we revisit the biggest Wall Street Ponzi scheme ever with an author who interviewed the late Bernie Madoff after it all came crashing down.
Why would a guy who was brilliant, who had a legitimate business worth at $1.3 billion, build simultaneously the biggest single criminal enterprise on Wall Street through this Ponzi scheme, over 40 years? And people are just always enraptured by something they initially trust. They may not understand it, but they believe in it, and then they find out it's all fake.
Jim Campbell on the infamous white-collar criminal and the new Netflix miniseries that explores the destruction he caused. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
Bernie fed on being the guy.
They always wanted to please everybody. They didn't want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg.
And the choice he made was he could live with himself as a liar much more easily than he could live with himself as a failure.
That's the trailer from a new Netflix documentary. It's out this past week. In it, you heard the voice of the subject, the late Bernie Madoff. The miniseries is entitled Madoff, the Monster of Wall Street. Hard to believe, but yes, it was nearly 14 years ago that Madoff pled guilty to 11 felony counts against him, including securities fraud, money laundering, and perjury.
For some, seeing Sam Bankman-Fried walking into the courthouse in Lower Manhattan this past week, charged with fraudulently raising $1.8 billion from investors, brought back memories of Madoff.
And that's right, Tim. Not apples to apples, but it definitely took me back to those days of Bernie Madoff and his own perp walk.
We've certainly, over the last few weeks, heard those comparisons. Well, someone who's talked with Madoff after his massive Ponzi scheme was uncovered and before he did pass away in 2021, of course, is Jim Campbell, host of the nationally syndicated radio show Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Also, the author of Madoff Talks, Uncovering the Untold Story Behind the Most Notorious Ponzi Scheme in History. Jim is included in the new Netflix documentary and joins us via Zoom from Greenwich, Connecticut. Why do you think, you know, more than a decade following this massive crime, there still remains so much interest in it?
First off, there's interest because FBF happened to go down right before the documentary comes out. There are a lot of similarities. But, you know, at the heart, this is an age-old, simple morality tale. Why would a guy who was brilliant, who had a legitimate business worth at $1.3 billion, build simultaneously the biggest single criminal enterprise on Wall Street through this Ponzi scheme over 40 years.
You're talking about Madoff right now, just for clarification.
I'm talking about Bernie, yeah, and it's the kind of Shakespearean drama that has always enraptured people. And again, here's a guy who betrayed his own sons, who betrayed his wife, who betrayed his Jewish community. 85% of the victims were Jewish or charities, something that's a sacrilege within the Jewish community to rip off a fellow person of the Jewish faith. And it's literally that kind of a story. And SBF brings similar kind of hubris, you know, that he built this thing and somehow vaporized overnight $32 billion of market value because his dog ate his homework, which doesn't even work in fifth grade. And then you find out, no, rather, it's a pretty sophisticated fraud as well. And people are just always enraptured by something they initially trust. They may not understand it, but they believe in it. And then they find out it's all fake.
Well, you know, it's interesting as we talk about Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX, Jim, and I think about Madoff. Like, what happens, do you think, having had conversations, right, and a lot of correspondence between yourself and Bernie Madoff, what is it that happens? Do they set out as true and ethical individuals on a mission, and then something goes terribly wrong, and they think they're going to truly catch up, and they just never do?
You know, that's a great question, because it's what you think could be the only explanation for Madoff. And he gave me a story like that. You know, Jim, I'm running this great legitimate business, which it was, and it was very ethically run, never screwed its clients, always got them the best price in his market making business. So you would think, ah, something happened. I lost some money like a gambler. I'm going to double down. We'll do a little Ponzi. No one will ever notice when I get it back. But here's the thing. He's running simultaneously to this business worth $3 billion in and of itself at the peak. He's building on the 17th floor, two floors below, behind locked doors, with ancient technology and high school graduates, this Ponzi scheme at the same time. And in Bernie's case, the psyche is not so much greed. It's that I've got to be the go-to guy. I've got to be the guy that everybody turns to. I've got to deliver. In fact, like many narcissists or sociopaths, and Joe Berlinger, who is the director of the Netflix, has spent his time with Jeffrey Epstein, Ted Bundy, these kinds of folks. And he sees the similar lack of empathy, the lack of remorse, the narcissism. And it's at the heart of this. SBF, I think, also believes that he's a fundamentally altruistic guy. He was in that altruistic effect. And yet, you look underneath what was going on there, and there was a lot of fraud. And the worst thing you can do on Wall Street is commingle client money with firm money, which on the street is stealing their money.
We should note that Sam Bankman-Fried has pleaded not guilty,
right,
and is, you know, still awaiting trial, which we anticipate will happen come October of this year, Carol.
Right, and I should note, I was quoting from the allegations in the charges.
Hey, one thing I think is interesting too, that, you know, once again though, Jim, we have oversight systems, big financial systems, you know, that
we're certainly in Bernie Madoff's case, you know, at some point you wonder, didn't somebody say, isn't this too good to be true? Even Samuel Bankman-Fried, I felt like there was a whole investment community that just wanted to buy into it and didn't want to, you know, FOMO in many ways. Do you blame the system too, the infrastructure that's out there?
I would say that this was a complete systemic failure.
SBF or Madoff or both?
Well, I'll get to SBF. But in the case of Madoff, the SEC had five different shots at him and never uncovered the Ponzi scheme. In fact, they kept reinvestigating him for what they cleared him of. And he clearly had a tremendous level of trust that he captured with the regulators and his investors. I never found people who understood what his strategy was, this split strike conversion that's actually conceptually very simple and therefore totally implausible that it would mirror the market to a 95% correlation and yet never went down. Makes no sense. SBF sent $73 million to politicians, 92% of whom were Democrat, and he had on his payroll as consultants, ex-CFTC, who is, as you know, the Commodities Futures Trading Commissioner, has oversight power. So you have regulatory capture here by two guys that built great reputations, which is a similarity, and the system failed. On the hedge fund Wall Street side, these feeder funds, remember, they feed their money to hedge fund managers. Their only job is essentially due diligence. This guy is real. This matches your portfolio. Boom, we put the money there. He passed all of his fees on to them. In return, they weren't allowed to do any due diligence. That's a huge abrogation of fiduciary responsibility.
Our thanks to Jim Campbell for joining us. He's the host of the nationally syndicated radio show, Business Talk with Jim Campbell. He's also the author of Madoff Talks, uncovering the untold story behind the most notorious Ponzi scheme in history.
Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, we turn our attention to two of my favorite subjects. We're talking about travel and wine. A bit later, we'll talk to sommelier and restaurateur Yannick Benjamin. He joins me, Tim, and our Bloomberg TV colleague Romain Bostic on how becoming paralyzed at age 25 motivated him to help other disabled people through his culinary platform.
You know, what we noticed, or I noticed along with the co-founder of the nonprofit, is that there are other individuals in the same rehab unit, and they just weren't getting the same love, care, and support as we were. And so we said, what if we start an organization where we act as a secondary family, where we provide them to help them achieve their objectives, and they're not like the forgotten people. And so that's the population that we really focus on. It's really just being able to use our resources to help others that have less.
And your restaurant, or at least the newest restaurant, I mean, takes that to heart there. I mean, the way you built out that restaurant, it is designed to make sure that it is all-inclusive.
100%. Yeah.
And up next, our intrepid Bloomberg Pursuits editor, Chris Rouser, is with us. He takes us down the path to vacation bliss with a guide to some of the best places in the world to visit. I will go to any of these.
We're looking at pictures to run of Kyushu, which is this volcanic island. They've got these crazy fruits and vegetables that grow there. And we were looking at one of the towns, Beppu, and there was all this smoke coming up from different places in the city, and it looked like the city was on fire. But what it actually was onsens, which are these spas that people go to, and it was steam coming out from all these different little places to go and relax and unwind. It feels like such a nice place to go, and it has new hotels opening and new onsen resorts. One of them even kind of in the woods near the city. The website, when you go to it, it says the dress code is naked.
Time to get your bags packed, passports ready, and go. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Oh yeah, it's a new year, and while there will be plenty of things to freak us out, we know that already, there will also be lots of super, super cool places to travel in 2023.
From Maine to the Marquesas, Bloomberg Businessweek's Pursuit section this week has a list of the 21 best places to go this year. We go through the list with none other than Chris Rauser, editor of Pursuits at Bloomberg Businessweek. Chris, well, there are so many amazing destinations to choose from. I mentioned two of them, but there are 19 more. How does your team compile a list like this?
It takes a long time. And it starts in the summer, and Nikki Eckstein, our amazing travel editor, keeps this hotel database where we know about every new hotel in the world, in the luxury sphere. And so we know what places kind of have heat and movement and are like attracting new visitors. And so she creates like a draft list over the summer, and then we spend the fall researching places, finding out what else is new, and putting together this list that's going to be most useful for our readers.
I love what you do too, is like you guys do think about, okay, what's new to this place, right? When there's either new hotels, new restaurants, I mean, that really goes into it in a big way.
Yeah, you know, a lot of other publications do a version of this list, and always we look at everybody's list, and like, there's a lot of overlap always. There's nothing you can do to avoid it, but some people focus on places you've never heard of, and some people focus on bargains. We focus on luxury news and access. So new hotels, new direct flights to a place that make it easier to get to from other places, new restaurants, as you said, an exciting restaurant scene. So just to give people an idea of what they're going to get when they go there.
I mean, Chris, you're from Maine, okay?
That's true. There might have been some favorites.
If there is one favorite place on the list this year for you, what is it?
The one that I think is the most interesting to me that I probably will not be able to get to this year is the Marquesas Islands, which are in French Polynesia, and they're in the middle of, like, literally in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And it's been hard to get there for tourists. It traditionally has been very difficult to access, although, of course, people live there. But now an increasing number of cruise ships are passing through, particularly Sven Olaf Lindblad, who is an adventurer and has for many years run a couple of cruise companies that do these kind of adventure trips. He is taking his personal yacht and going there to do maritime research. And also you can charter out his yacht to go and explore these areas. And it's just, there's an amazing culture there. There's amazing wildlife. It's like these volcanic islands that come out of the sea.
That's stunning.
I like that there are still adventurers in 2023, like that you could still be an adventurer.
I know, right? Isn't that, I mean,
that's on my list of things to do.
Yeah. You can go to the Marquesas Islands or you can go to space.
What? Wait, is that
on the list?
Not on the list. Hey, but go back to Maine. How come Maine? It's in our backyard, because there's a few places that are essentially, for those who live in the United States, in our backyard.
So, yeah. So Maine, I always say, feels like a foreign country in your own backyard. And over the last 10 years, Maine has gotten really hot, especially during the pandemic, because it does feel quite far away. It's got a very distinct geography. It has a distinct food way, seafood, very seafood based, obviously lobster, but it's very quiet. And it does not feel urban at all. Mm. And it's easy to get to. So, you know, there's been tons and tons of restaurants, particularly in Portland, which is the biggest city, with really great chefs from New York and San Francisco, cocktail bars. And then there's also some restaurants that are these little resorts that are up along the coast. And you can go, and it's like Aragosta at Goose Cove, which is on Deer Isle, which is pretty far up the coast, is this little inn where you can, there's got 12 rooms and little villas. You can go stay there. And then there's this big tasting tasting menu meal that you go, because you go to sort of experience the chef experience because it's owned by a chef. You can eat in this glass pavilion on the water as the sun sets. And it's just like the most relaxing thing I can possibly think of.
I have to say, my husband lived in Maine for about 9 months a long time ago, and he said it was the most beautiful place. And I do feel like, and I've gone there with him just to visit, it is one of those places where you feel like you can breathe and like the nature, and just, it's just stunning.
It's quiet. And people really fish, they hunt, they ski, they kayak, they canoe. Like, it's really that.
They sail.
Like, they sail, yeah.
Okay, there's also some great data in this piece. You know, you guys ended up finding some data from Google and getting an understanding of when the best places to go to these locations is. How did you do that?
So we do this every year, and this is what makes our offering kind of special. We, because we're Bloomberg and we're a big data company, we go to each of these locations and we talk to a travel provider in the location, so like a travel agent who's an expert, and we say, okay, when are the times to go? Mm-hmm. So for example, for Maine, you know, you want to go from like July through October because that's summer through foliage, and then in the winter you might want to go skiing, which is fun too, January, February. But you may not know that June is like real black fly season in Maine and you don't want to go.
They take big bites out of you?
Yeah, they take, yes. And then we put that on a chart of the months of the year, and we overlay it with data from Google Hotels, which tells us when hotel prices go up and down throughout the year. So you can look and see when's a good time and when's a cheap time, and when do those things overlap and pick the best time to go.
I'm an off-season kind of person. My husband and I have done that a lot of times. Just a little bit off-season because it's not as crowded. And
I'll see you in Maine in June with the black flies.
No, exactly. We do not like flies. Tell me why, though, Ivory Coast. I love this one.
Oh, yeah. So Ivory Coast is beginning to sort of compete with some of the other countries that are like more familiar to world travelers in Africa. And it has Abidjan, the capital, has its first like major international hotel brand, its first Marriott opening up. And there's just a lot of resorts on the coast, Ivory Coast coast, that are very beautiful and family friendly. And there's a lot of life and culture. And it's just our writer actually lived there for a long time and says, you know, this is something that a lot of people internationally don't know about. And we really wanted to boost it and we're psyched about it.
Yeah, it sounds like one of those gems that many haven't discovered yet, which sounds really, really
cool.
Yeah,
and the picture we have of this hotel is the Noom Hotel is just like, it looks really amazing and cool and modern.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about soaking away stress in Japan's third largest island, Kyushu.
Yes, Kyushu. So we were looking at pictures to run of Kyushu, which is this great, it's on this hillside because it's a volcanic island. They've got these crazy fruits and vegetables that grow there. And we were looking at one of the towns, Beppu, and pictures of it, and there was all this smoke coming up from different places in the city, and it looked like the city was on fire. But what it actually was onsens, which are these spas that people go to, and it was steam coming out all these different little places to go and relax and unwind throughout the city, because there's so many of them. It feels like such a nice, great place to go. And it's really, it has new hotels opening and new onsen resorts. One of them even kind of in the woods near the city. The website, when you go to it, it says the dress code is naked.
Okay, well yeah. Now. If you had to pick a place, maybe one or two that you would want to go in 2023. I know we talked about this a little bit at the top.
No Maine.
Going there. You know, I always love unexpected American places because most of us on my team are American. And so we have...
We're like, get out of the country. Yeah, no, we love this country, but...
So San Francisco is I think, something that people should give a second thought this year. There's a lot of headlines about how, like, office spaces in downtown is very empty.
Yeah.
But actually, the neighborhoods are really thriving and there's incredible restaurant scenes and very cool hotels going in.
I love San Francisco.
And then Macon, Georgia is a place that I have heard of, but had not thought about going to. And it has incredible history, a great music life, and history that goes back thousands of years, like indigenous history. There's an incredible historic park there and a bunch of new hotels and just like a great restaurant scene. And it just seems like one of those perfect small cities in America to go to and just immerse yourself for a few days.
Where can you find value on this list?
Cue the crickets. No, I'm just kidding.
You know, actually, Toronto is a great city to go to if you're Americans. There's a lot of urban development development going on there. And then Istanbul is on this list too. They have had crazy inflation and their currency has dropped. So there's a lot of people going there looking for deals. It actually means that it's very buzzy and crowded in terms of international tourists. But there's also a lot of infrastructure there, great new hotels. There's a peninsula right on the water. They built this cruise ship port on the Bosphorus, which is actually underground. So like a giant cruise ship pulls into an indoor harbor, and there's all these restaurants and hotels and stuff all around this Gataport
area. So you can't see it?
Yeah, so it just like goes away. Can you imagine one of the cruise ships going to Manhattan, you know, when you see them on the west side and just like parking inside somewhere?
A huge garage underwater.
Yeah, so that's, if you want to go luxury shopping, the shops can't keep up with the price changes.
I'm just going to say, I think there's like a 21-part series for the three of us to like just check out
each
of these.
Well, we'll have to go. Yeah.
Well, that's the point.
Yeah.
Chris, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Happy New Year.
That is our friend and colleague, Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rouser, with your 2023 travel itinerary. Check out the full list in the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's out on newsstands now, online, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Coming up next, we wrap up with New York sommelier and restaurateur Yannick Benjamin on combining food and wine with belonging.
This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek from Bloomberg Radio.
As we get ready to wrap up this week, we wanted to bring you a little bit of our last interview of 2022. It was with Yannick Benjamin. He's a sommelier and restaurateur behind East Harlem restaurant Contento. He's also making hospitality accessible to everyone as a co-founder of Wheeling Forward. That group works with and helps recently disabled people that lack a support system and resources to obtain the services that they need.
It's something he knows a lot about, as Yannick was paralyzed below the waist at the age of 25 following a car accident. He joined us along with Bloomberg TV's Romain Bostic, and before we sampled some wine, we discussed his restaurant, Contento, and his inspiration for jumpstarting a philanthropic organization while dealing with his own injuries.
You know, what we noticed, or I noticed along with the co-founder of the nonprofit, is that there are other individuals in the same rehab unit, and they just weren't getting the same love, care, and support as we were. And so we said, what do we start an organization where we act as a secondary family, where we provide them to help them achieve their objectives, and they're not like the forgotten people. And so that's the population that we really focus on. It's really just being able to use our resources to help others that have less.
And your restaurant takes that to heart there. I mean, the way you built out that restaurant,
yes.
It is designed to make sure that it is all-inclusive.
100%. Yeah. The name of the restaurant, Contento, it's up in East Harlem on 111th Street, and counter seating. So means that all of us can all go to the bar together and we're all looking at each other eye to eye, which is really nice. So there's not this like I'm looking up at you. And I think that's really nice. We have adaptive flatware for those that have, you know, neurological issues or they're arthritic with their hands, and they're beautiful flatware. So that goes a long way, and menus in Braille. So just those simple little things, you know, it really empowers people and makes them feel really safe and comfortable to go to a place where they go, oh my God, I'm provided with the resources to have a great dinner or lunch with dignity.
They feel like they belong.
They feel like they belong. That's exactly right.
Is New York City an accessible place? Well, the reason I ask is because this is in New York City.
Yes.
It's a place that I think many people would say is, well, accessible in some respects, but not in many.
Listen, New York City is still one of the greatest cities in the world. I'm born and raised here, but there's still a lot of work to be done. I would say that now we do have a lot more wheelchair accessible yellow cabs. So there is improvement that's being made. But yeah, we still have a lot more work to do. That's for sure.
In all seriousness, though, we talk about sort of what makes a restaurant the gathering place. We talked about during the pandemic, we had all so many discussions about how the closure of restaurants for a lot of us kind of destroyed the community, because these restaurants for a lot of us are our community, the local places where you can go and you can meet with people. So to have a place that is inclusive where you can bring all your family members and everyone there can enjoy wine, food, whatever else, that's obviously been a big part, I think, of what has made Contento so successful. And I've been there. I should just, full disclosure, I've eaten there. It's a great place. And also, I wonder if you're starting to see other restaurants sort of, I guess, get hip to this idea.
For sure. And I've had other restaurateurs and other people in the business reach out to me asking for advice and, oh, where'd you get your menus in Braille? Or what could we be doing better? I mean, which is a great thing, because we don't want to be known as the first and only restaurant that's, you know, taking this initiative. And the most important thing is not to be the last one. right? And so please, by all means, every restaurant, any business, copy us, by all means, that's what we want. And listen, you can't get emotionally incentivized. Financially incentivized, I'll give you some numbers.
Yeah.
There's over 61 million Americans that have a disability, right? That means that's 1 in 4, which is a huge number, right? And within that population, there's over $500 billion of spending power.
That is Yannick Benjamin with Carol, Romain Bostic, and me. Yannick's behind one of New York City's most cutting-edge and inclusive restaurants, Contento, in East Harlem. And he co-founded Wheeling Forward. It's a philanthropic organization for the disabled. A really great conversation to close out 2022 and also help bring in the new year in style.
Yeah, the wine was great, but I gotta say, I loved his inspiration the most.
It was a really nice way to end the year.
Absolutely. All right, that wraps up the weekend edition, our first edition of the new year of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks a lot for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovec. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and always on the Bloomberg terminal.
Also, check us out on Bloomberg Quick Take, available at Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Stay safe. This is Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.